Good morning, everyone.
This is an exciting moment for us. I mean, China-Europe relations are not particularly well understood here. Have not been particularly well understood in Washington, and that's really been a shame and something that I know many of us have spent time trying to understand better in the last couple of years in particular. I think if you took the temperature of Europeans and Chinese on China, or Europeans and U.S. citizens on China 4 years ago, you'd have had a radically different set of opinions on what China's rise meant for Europe, or what China's meant for the rise meant for the United States. There does seem to be a bit of a coming together of opinions, not necessarily for the good in all cases, but there does seem to be a coming together of opinion. But the point is, for folks in the United States and for folks in Washington in particular, understanding Europe's approach to China is pretty important. We don't really understand. If we lack that understanding, frankly, we lack a crucial set of tools and a crucial set of metrics by which we can judge our own relationship with China and, frankly, with Europe at the same time. We've got a great group of folks here that some of you, most of are strangers to a few of you, I'm sure. But the project that we've got in front of you, China-U.S. Relations, or China-Europe Relations, Implications and Policy Responses for the United States, is something that Dr. Bates Gill and Melissa Murphy have spent a lot of time on over the last year or so. Bates, as some of you know, was my predecessor here at the Freeman Chair in China Studies. I am Charles Freeman, the Freeman Chair in China Studies. Now Bates is still one of the U.S. Foremost experts on China, writ large, political and security in particular. Now based in Europe and in Stockholm, at the Stockholm International, I'm going to get the acronym wrong, CIPRI, which is Research Institute, which is the leading think tank in Stockholm. And frankly, Bates and I and David Shambaugh were just, who's sitting to his left, were just in Stockholm for the last few days talking with not only Europeans about China, but also with Chinese and other Asians about the trilateral relationship such as it is. To Bates's right is somebody that I hope all of you get to know even better than you may already know now, and that's Melissa Murphy, who's at the Freeman Chair and is really one of the leading lights, in my opinion, looking at political change in China. And she has good European credentials as well, as you'll see as soon as I turn the mic over to her, a British educated and born, but proudly holding her green card as we speak. And then sort of to look at this and offer some wisdom is David Shambaugh, who spent an awful lot of time, much longer than anybody in this room, looking at the China-Europe relationship, and therefore is almost uniquely qualified to address not only the substance of this report, but more broadly speaking, the relationships in general. David is, as all of you know, I'm sure, is at the George Washington University, has his credentials, as you'll see in front of you, if you do have the sheet, are impeccable, and really, that leaves me with the benefit of not having to say too much about David. Let me turn it over to Melissa to talk about some of the economic and human rights and other applications of the report, and we'll then turn it over to Bates and then ask David to make some comments. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Charles, for your very kind introduction. I'd like to begin by noting that one of the most interesting aspects of being involved in a long-term research study such as this one is watching the shifting sands of geopolitical relations. When we began the initial research around the end of 2005, there was residual strain in the transatlantic relationship, and by contrast, very cozy China-EU relations. However, during the course of the research, we witnessed not only a rapprochement across the Atlantic, but also a perceptible shift, if not hardening, of European attitudes towards China. This was perhaps most visible in the economic and trade ties, which I will review this morning, as well as touching on some of the issues of human rights before handing the floor over to Bates. Since the two sides formally declared their intention to create a comprehensive strategic partnership in 2001, China-Europe ties have greatly intensified. In the early 2000s, with a deterioration in US-EU relations, which was in large measure resulting from differences over the US approach to Iraq, as well as disagreements over the EU decision to consider lifting the arms embargo on Beijing, analysts considered the EU-China relationship to be part of a new restructuring in global great power relations. Indeed, in 2006, the two sides agreed to launch negotiations to achieve a single overarching partnership and cooperation agreement, PCA. By updating and replacing the 1985 Trade and Economic Agreement, which was the basis of a relationship, the PCA is intended to cover not only traditional economic relations, but will also provide a comprehensive and legally binding basis for an enhanced political relationship between China and the EU. However, while the relationship has definitely continued to deepen and the flurry of top-level exchanges of visits and meetings has continued apace, the EU began to evince a more sober and demanding view of China, which was evident in the 2006 EU Commission communication, which is entitled EU-China, Closer Partners, Growing Responsibilities, as well as an EU Council document that was issued at the end of the year, which basically stated that while the EU remains committed to continuing maturing of relations with China, these relationships must be balanced, reciprocal, and mutually beneficial. During the 2006-2007 period, different leaders also emerged across Europe who held somewhat tougher and more skeptical views towards China than their predecessors. Merkel in Germany, Sarkozy in France, and Brown in the United Kingdom, as well as Peter Mandelson replacing Pascal Lamy as the EU Trade Commissioner. By the beginning of 2007, then, the relationship had clearly started to flatten out as new irritants emerged, and this was arguably most visible in the area of economic and trade ties, as the Europeans also began to feel the pinch of economic competition with China. The EU trade deficit, according to one estimate, was over 170 billion euros at the end of 2007, and that's a 25% increase year on year. In contrast to what had been perceived as a fairly measured approach by the EU on trade disputes, economic and trade officials began to very publicly step up pressure on China on a range of issues. These developments at the EU official level reflect and are reflected by increasingly negative views among the European public towards China. And you can refer to a table on page 7 of the report for details. But according to the Pew Global Attitude Survey, Europeans have become much more critical of China since 2005. For example, those holding favorable views of China in the UK have fallen from 65% in 2005 to 49% in 2007, from 58% in France to 47%, and in Germany from 46% to 34%. There are also growing fears among Europeans about whether China's growing power is really something positive for their own country. These are the sort of the views that we're more used to hearing from the US public. As a result, many analysts were now reporting that the China-EU honeymoon was over. Turning to some of the specific issues in the US, the EU-China economic trade ties, clearly the most obvious area of growth and common interest in China-EU relations has traditionally been in business ties. Trade has grown some hundredfold since diplomatic relations were established in 1975. China is the second biggest trading partner for the EU after the US, and the EU became China's largest trading partner in 2004. Beyond the growing trade and investment in the private sector, at the official level, the two sides are also engaged in a range of sectoral dialogues, which are intended to address areas of common concern and provide a more solid foundation for the relationship. As of early 2008, the two sides were conducting 23 such dialogues. They take place at various levels, from the working level to the ministerial level, and involve officials, politicians, and business people. The dialogues include energy, the environment, food and product safety, and a full list is available on page 11 of the report. However, since late 2006 and accelerating in the latter half of 2007, economic and trade problems have assumed a more prominent place in EU-China relations. In February 2007, the EU published the findings of a study which outlined some of the main sticking points in their economic relationship. And in July, Peter Mandelson declared that the EU-China trading relationship was at a crossroads. He warned China of both, and I quote, rising public hostility and frustration among European governments that would put him under pressure to shut European markets to mainland exports. Reflecting growing European concern on these questions and to address these issues much more closely, it was agreed at the 10th China-EU summit, which was held in November of 2007, that the two sides would establish a high-level economic and trade dialogue, which is akin to the US-China strategic economic dialogue, which is already in place. Turning to some of the specific trade disputes between the two sides, two of the most important and interrelated problems involve the valuation of the Chinese currency and the growing EU trade deficit with China. Although the renminbi has appreciated, because it is managed in relation to a basket of currencies that are heavily weighted toward the US dollar, the US dollar's slide against the euro has actually exacerbated the China-EU trade deficit. So as in the United States in recent years, the EU is now facing an ever-growing trade deficit with Beijing. The issue is becoming a bigger political problem for the relationship, because not only does it garner attention from the bureaucrats in Brussels, it's also gaining attention among the increasingly frustrated public for whom China has, rightly or wrongly, become a symbol of the negative impact of globalization in Europe. In contrast to the EU's previously soft touch, officials are now demanding Beijing take steps to address its swelling trade surplus and to allow faster appreciation of the yuan. In November 2007, the two sides, in response, agreed to set up a working group between the European Central Bank and the People's Bank of China to address exchange rate issues. Regarding unfair trade practices and WTO disputes, initially, the EU was a very enthusiastic supporter of China's entry into the WTO. In 2002, former EU Trade Commissioner Pascal Lamy said the EU intended to deal with future China trade issues with a distinctively European approach, noting that the EU would avoid excessively legalistic approach used by some other major trading partners of China, i.e. the United States. But by 2007, the mood had changed considerably. A series of trade disputes that erupted over textiles, shoes, and other things in 2005 to 2006 led to charges from Brussels of Beijing's unfair trading practices and from Beijing of rising European trade protectionism. The issue further spotlighted the impact of EU enlargement on the China-EU economic relationship, as an apparent split appeared in Europe between the free trade North European countries, whose retailers obviously profit from cheap Chinese imports, and the protectionist South Central European countries for whose manufacturers these imports obviously pose a very serious threat. China is currently the largest target of trade investigations by the EU. Some 100 anti-dumping and other trade measures are being considered or applied. In 2006, the EU joined the United States for the first time as a co-complainant at the WTO in a case involving auto parts. And in March 2008, the EU and US again filed a joint complaint at the WTO regarding restrictions on foreign news providers in China. Another thorny issue between the two sides is intellectual property rights. According to EU sources, some 80% of the counterfeit goods confiscated at their borders are sourced from China. In a sign of growing impatience with what Brussels views as Beijing's lax IPR enforcement efforts, the EU also joined as an observer with the US on a US WTO case against IPR theft in April of 2007. This resulted in Beijing cancelling the IPR dialogue with Brussels that year. And finally, in the wake of the public outcry over a string of scandals involving unsafe Chinese imports of food and children's toys at the end of 2007, the EU Commission said it would consider a ban on such imports if China failed to make significant progress on product safety. And Mandelson once again riled the Chinese by pointing out that although Chinese officials claim that less than 1% of exports to the EU have health risks, he said even 1% was not acceptable. In response, then-Chinese Vice Premier Wu Yi said she was extremely dissatisfied with Mandelson's remarks and accused importers of Chinese goods in Europe of using food and product safety as an excuse for protectionism. Indeed, while defending itself against charges of unfair trade practices, China has responded with countercharges that it is a victim of a rising trade protectionism in Europe. Beijing also continues to criticize the EU for its reluctance, along with the United States, to grant China market economy status, pointing to the fact that Russia, which still does not qualify for WTO membership, has been granted market economy status, China charges that it is a victim of realpolitik. Without market economy status, China remains an easy target for foreign anti-dumping measures. And turning lastly to the issue of human rights, which remains really one of the most sensitive issues in China-EU relations, members of the European Parliament, who have long been very vocal on the issue, continue to urge EU leaders to push Beijing more forcefully on human rights, the rule of law, and the protection of national minorities in China. In January 2008, the EP lawmakers called on China to release political activist Hu Jia from detention and called on member states to reconsider their participation in the Beijing Olympics. In the wake of the events in Tibet in March 2008, the EU presidency aired a declaration saying it was deeply concerned about the situation and calling for restraint on all sides. German Chancellor Merkel announced she would not attend the Olympics. Her decision was preceded by similar announcements from Poland and the Czech Republic and was followed by a similar announcement by British Prime Minister Gordon Brown. However, previously in 2007, the EU Commissioner for External Relations had actually acknowledged that China had been making remarkable progress on the issue of human rights. In fact, China-EU Dialogue on Human Rights was launched in 1996, and they held their 24th meeting in October of 2007. The EU remains very much involved in human rights and good governance issues at the grassroots level in China. In 2005, €435,000 was made available to NGOs working in China on civil society and protecting the rights of national minorities. However, in a reminder of the sensitivity with which Beijing views what it considers internal matters, in March 2008, China expressed strong dissatisfaction with the EU discussions of and comments on the ongoing situation in Tibet, saying that no foreign country has the right to interfere. In conclusion, however, I would like to say that in spite of the aforementioned difficulties and the more realistic and sober view of one another that emerged during the course of the research for this report, as well as the likelihood of some very tough discussions ahead, the differences should not be overstated. On the contrary, they should be viewed as part and parcel of a maturing and all-around developing China-EU relationship. As Chinese Foreign Minister Yang Jiechi said in December of 2007, the bottom line is that the two sides have neither fundamental conflicts of interest nor outstanding historical issues standing between them. Indeed, they share sufficient common interests, especially in the economic and trade realm, that over the long term will likely keep both sides working towards developing a comprehensive and strategic partnership. The honeymoon may be over, but is unlikely to lead to a divorce. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Melissa, for that comprehensive overview of the work we did on this report related to economic, trade, and human rights questions. It's my task to cover a little bit of some of the other issues that we do in this report and then also lay out some of the fundamental conclusions and recommendations which we reached. Before doing that, I do want to extend my gratitude to Charles Freeman and the Freeman Chair in China Studies for the opportunity to see that this report were completed and for the opportunity to be here today to lay it out for all of you here. And thanks also to David Chambaugh, who, as Charles indicated, really is, I would say, the father, if you will, of studies related to China-Europe relations, and his presence here in the United States since returning to London from London many, many years ago has really driven this work forward. So we're very glad he could be here. As Melissa indicated, I think the broad takeaway from this report is that there is a deepening and more regularized and institutionalized set of relationships between Europe and China that I think most Americans are hardly aware of. And it behooves us here in Washington to be smarter about it, not necessarily in a confrontational or hostile way or zero-sum way, but rather to become smarter, more understanding, recognizing its implications, and where possible, indeed, to work more closely with our European counterparts to achieve common goals with China and ultimately to work with China and European partners together to address global challenges. We've seen, yes, also a second important takeaway that moving from a sort of a honeymoon period to a more mature relationship, but the comments that Melissa made at the end are very, very important. While it's moving into a more mature relationship, I don't think we should have any expectations of any sort of sudden downturn or any kind of a hostility arising. The fundamentals of Europe-China relations are very good, and I suspect lay out the likelihood of further deepening, further regularization, further institutionalization of this relationship. And in the report, we do sort of lay out why that is the case. You know, what are some of the fundamental differences in approach that the United States has toward China versus Europe? And while there are differences in our approaches, we fundamentally conclude that that does not mean the United States and Europe should be on different sides of this question, but rather ought to be doing much, much more in the way of learning from one another and seeking common outcomes in their relationship with China. In the report, then, we go into some detail, as Melissa already has, with regard to economics, trade, human rights-related issues, and also in the broadening agenda of EU-China security-related cooperation. We lay out five key areas in which this is taking place. Most of these relationships between Europe and China today, I would characterize as being somewhat on the softer side of security relations and involve things like, you know, deepening strategic dialogues, military-to-military diplomacy, widening educational exchanges between defense institutions between China and Europe. Peacekeeping training is an area of growth we can expect to see between China and Europe, and also some basic joint military exercises, port visits, and the like. But interestingly, even on broader questions of global security and strategy, we see, at least in the form of EU-China summitry, quite interesting joint statements, quite lengthy and detailed, about where China and Europe can work together to address the full panoply of emerging global security concerns, including in East Asia, but also, of course, on other questions like in Afghanistan or in Africa, addressing questions of non-proliferation, addressing questions of emerging infectious diseases that might have security implications, and the like. The point is that the European leadership and the Chinese leadership are meeting frequently, often in regularized ways, and have ample opportunity to discuss and reach common positions on how they want to approach global security issues. For example, at the EU-China summit in November of 2007, the two sides jointly spoke of the importance of effective multilateralism. That's a favorite buzzword of our European friends, and their joint support for a fair, just, and rules-based multilateral international system with the UN playing a central role. So this is a common sort of basic fundamental worldview that the Chinese and the Europeans claim to share that we might argue differs somewhat from the way the United States would look at things. Looking ahead, I think it's also likely that China's expanding role in Africa is going to become an area of potential greater concern, certainly for the Europeans. And there is an intention, at least, between the EU and China to engage in regular dialogue about their respective approaches to activities in Africa. This, I think, reflects China's growing role there, both in the public and private sectors, and even more specifically, China's growing role in the region as a peacekeeper, which is also the intention, I think, over the longer term for the European Union as well. On non-proliferation and arms control, similarly, a positive and deepening engagement between the two sides, including, of course, a regularized dialogue between the European Union as well as many European capitals with China on issues of strengthening export controls on weapons of mass destruction and other sensitive technologies and equipment. And also training by the European side to help China develop and strengthen its own domestic export control regulatory frameworks and enforcement procedures. The two sides meet regularly and often, not only in their bilateral summits, but in the context of those non-proliferation regimes in which they are joint members, such as the Nuclear Suppliers Group, as well as the global organizations like the International Atomic Energy Agency and others. Maybe one of the best examples of ongoing cooperation between Europe and China is with regard to the concerns we have about Iranian nuclear ambitions, China being one of the major parties to the ongoing negotiations with Iran and has stepped up in recent months, in fact, convening one of the gatherings of the group to discuss Iranian nuclear intentions and holding it in Shanghai just a few months ago. That being seen in Europe as a major step ahead for China to pick up some of its responsibility and act responsibly along with European and American partners to see some resolution on the Iranian nuclear question. The report also goes into some detail about ongoing peacekeeping, military transparency, military-to-military exchanges which go on between Europe and China, which are definitely deepening, and I suspect we'll see more and more of this kind of activity going forward. I devote a good bit of time in the report to the question of military technology transfers to China and the question of the EU arms embargo, which is one, obviously, of major importance to many here in the United States when we think about the EU-China relationship. I could go into some detail here, but I don't want to take too much time. But the fact is that the so-called EU arms embargo is not an arms embargo at all. It is entirely misunderstood here in the United States about what it means and what it can and cannot accomplish. The fact of the matter is that the so-called arms embargo is about seven words expressed in a much larger document in June 1989 in reaction to the bloodshed in and around Tiananmen Square that year. The so-called embargo said that European countries, and at the time there were only 12 countries, and it wasn't even the EU at that time, it was the EC, the European Community, those 12 countries should not trade in arms with China, and that's all it said. In practice, the arms embargo has never really worked, at least it hasn't been a blanket embargo. It is not legally binding. It was simply a political statement of the 12 members of the European Community at the time. And in practice, European countries continued to export weapons and military technology to China. In essence, the arms embargo has left it up to individual countries to make decisions based upon their own national laws and export control regulations about what to trade with China and what not to. And I go into detail about the various systems and so forth. And there's an appendix in the back of the report drawing from CPRI data, which lays out the ongoing military technology relationship between European countries and China. So the main point to understand about the arms embargo is that it isn't an embargo, and that arms trade has indeed gone on between European countries and China in spite of it. When I get to the recommendations, we'll talk about what needs to be done about that and why we need to improve our understanding of the situation here in Washington. Finally, on the security front, we talk a little bit about Europe's approach to the cross-strait relations and the Taiwan issue. And again, not dissimilar from what we've said on other aspects of the EU-China relationship. We have seen, in essence, over recent years, a more forthright European approach to this question, which converges pretty closely with the American approach to the Taiwan question, such that in late 2007, as a part of the EU-China summit joint statement, China put an enormous amount of pressure upon the EU to include in that joint statement some pretty tough language about Chen Shui-bian and the opposition to the referendum and the need for Taiwan not to unilaterally change the status quo across the strait. So in essence, really coming very close, hewing very close to the American position on that. In the report, we also take on some other things besides economics, human trade, human rights, and security, things like deepening science and technology cooperation between Europe and China, deepening space-related cooperation between both the EU, Brussels, and China, and individual countries in Europe, which carry out space-related cooperation. Education and cultural exchanges. I don't want to waste the time to look for the specific figures here, but let's see. As of 2007, European universities host some 170,000 Chinese students as compared to about 67,000 students in the United States. That's a very interesting statistic, I think. 75,000 of those 170 are in the United Kingdom. China has also been extremely active in expanding its Confucius Institutes program across Europe. So I think the big takeaway from the descriptive aspect of the report is there's a lot going on. Deepening, regularized, institutionalized, and it's obviously going to have an impact upon how Europe-China relations evolve and the way that Europe is going to relate to the United States vis-a-vis China. We need to do a better job of understanding these dynamics and hopefully coming to some common ground with both our European and Chinese partners about these developments. To turn to the conclusion and recommendations, we argue that any approach by the United States to the deepening dynamic of China-Europe ties needs to be prudent, pragmatic, and balanced, and obviously should have three principal goals in mind. First, any approach to this question should surely strengthen, not weaken, transatlantic relations. And secondly, improving transatlantic consultation and cooperation on the question of China's rise and emergence in world affairs with an aim to encouraging that emergence as a more constructive and responsible international partner. And then finally, we need to think a lot harder over the longer term about how this trilateral relationship can find mechanisms and means to work together to effectively address the global challenges of the 21st century. One issue which I didn't mention here, which I should have in terms of EU-China cooperation, is on the question of energy and climate change. This is just coming from Stockholm a couple of days ago, where there was a major meeting on transatlantic relations and China. It was very, very clear that this is going to become priority one for Europeans in their relationship vis-a-vis China, and surely ought to be in our relationship with China as well, and stands out, I think, as one of the principal areas where these three partners ought to be thinking a lot harder about cooperation and common ground. But based on those three principal goals, strengthening transatlantic relations, improving consultation to encourage a more responsible and productive relationship with China, and to foster trilateral cooperation, we then go forward with five principal sets of recommendations. The first is we need to do a much better job here in the United States, devote more time and effort to understanding the dynamic of China-Europe relations and its implications, both for opportunities and potential challenges that then face the United States. This would have to include things like greater investment in research and analysis, both in the public and private sectors, for our government in Washington to reach out more frequently and more seriously to the academic, non-governmental, and private sector specialists who are already engaged on the question of China-Europe relations. Secondly, we ought to be trying to sustain and deepen transatlantic dialogue and consultation regarding China. Remarkably, it was not until just 3 years ago, almost to the day, that Washington and Brussels held their first formal consultations on the issue of China and Asia. This was prompted by the arms embargo debacle, which unfolded in early 2005, and sort of forced the two parties to realize the importance of talking to one another or risk serious rifts in the relationship. Now, this was something that David and I and many others had been calling for many, many years, precisely because we saw the train wreck coming on the arms embargo. So while it was forced sort of to be initiated because of a crisis, at least it's now been sustained for about 3 years. But my sense is that this has not been taken on board happily by our friends in the State Department who don't need yet another round of consultations and meetings to have to undertake. The protocol level has also steadily declined since May 2005. And my big concern is that as we go into a new administration, the whole process itself might be dropped altogether. So we recommend that the administration give an early signal in 2009 of their intention to sustain and hopefully raise the level of their dialogue vis-a-vis China and Asia more broadly. Third, we argue that it's important that we look at our comparative advantages in our dealings with China. Clearly, the United States can bring some things to the table in our relationship with China that the Europeans cannot, but it's also true that Europeans bring special advantages in their relationships with China that the United States cannot. And as part of our consultation and dialogue, we should be looking to see how it might be possible to be more complementary with one another in our approaches towards China and, where possible, harmonize. But I use that word extremely carefully, harmonize our approaches toward China. This is not and should not be seen as an attempt to gang up on China or to contain China. It is quite the opposite. I think it's more wisely thought to be an effort to complement one another's efforts in cooperation with China to make sure that over the long term, China emerges as a cooperative and constructive and responsible international partner. Fourthly, we take some time to look at the specific issue of the arms embargo, and maybe this will be one of the more controversial recommendations to come out of this report. But we believe that over the longer term, we need to think of a way out of this impasse. That is to say, a process by which the so-called arms embargo is lifted, but in its place will be a more effective mechanism, EU-wide mechanism, which is legally binding, and which would stem, not increase, which would stem the possibility of transfers of sensitive advanced technologies and weapons to China. And in the process of lifting the embargo, seek from China, in return for that, some concessions on their side on certain issues. This mechanism is basically in place and ready to go forward. However, because of the complete misunderstanding in Washington about what the arms embargo is and isn't, political leaders in Europe are understandably extremely gun-shy about moving down this path. And I think for political reasons only, we're likely to stay in this sort of no-man's land where there's an embargo that doesn't work, weapons and technology trade continues to flow from Europe to China. China continues to have a sense of victimhood and animosity towards both the United States and Europe because it is being singled out to be targeted as a country that should not be seen as a normal country in because of its human rights record and because of concerns we have about China's military buildup. But the issues on human rights, the issues of China's military buildup, are not being properly addressed under the current so-called arms embargo. So arms embargo needs to be lifted. That has to be done in close consultation with the United States, but replaced with a more effective mechanism, and in so doing also extract concessions from China on issues of human rights, treatment of ethnic minorities, and signing on and ratifying the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And then finally, the fifth major recommendation is to think in the long term about how we can build a more effective trilateral approach to global challenges, which involve these three major power centers working in greater concert. A part of that process, I think, has to include questions of social, economic, and political development inside China itself, and to see to positive changes there through the kind of cooperation which European, American, and Chinese entities can foster to bring about a more just, a more prosperous, a more stable, a more equitable China going forward. This is a pretty ambitious agenda, and we conclude with, I think, some pretty realistic understandings of how difficult it would actually be to put all of these recommendations into place. Obviously, the United States over the next year is going to be consumed with not only the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and our economic problems, but the whole issue of getting a new administration in place and up to speed is going to be overwhelming. China, too, has its own domestic concerns to be looking inward, and Europe is going to be largely looking inward as well as it tries to put into place the Treaty of Lisbon and establish a more coherent security and foreign policy. So probably in the next year or two, much of this is going to be difficult to achieve, but nevertheless, I think we need to recognize that the interrelationships of these three power centers are becoming more complex and more global in scope and are surely greater than the sum of their three parts. And it would be wise for all of us to be thinking more strategically about our relations and putting in place mechanisms over time that would help us address the major challenges that are rising on the global agenda for the 21st century. So thank you very much, and I'd like to hear some comments from David.
Well, my first comment is I endorse everything you and Melissa have written in this fine report and commend it to all of you and beyond to read. It's really an excellent, excellent new study of a... Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay.
Melissa, can you...
Uh-huh. Now, this is really a superb new study on China-Europe relations and the implications for the U.S. and the transatlantic relationship. I think it's a kind of model for what Washington think tanks should be doing with their time and resources. So I commend you and I guess the Smith Richardson Foundation as well for seeing the importance of this project. I've, as Bates has mentioned, kind of been laboring in the wilderness on this subject for a very long time. And I welcome those who are joining this research and joining this project. It's beginning to attract the kind of attention. Well, one hopes it's beginning to attract the kind of attention. And they're trying through this report to stimulate such needed attention to it. Let me, in my time, try and do three things this morning. One is to offer some very general comments about the report. Obviously, you can read it for yourself. Secondly, to identify a few variables that will affect the China-Europe relationship going forward in time, something that Bates and Melissa didn't really do in the report. As we think over the next year or two, to try and identify a few things that might affect that relationship, at least from my own perspective. And third, then, just to offer, to endorse their policy recommendations and to offer maybe a few additional ones. Let me also just commend, if I can, this, not only their report, there are two others that are appearing within a two-week span. All of a sudden, there is a sort of miniature explosion of study reports on the China-Europe relationship, theirs being one of the most important. But the Center for European Reform in London has just produced this week a brand-new report entitled Can Europe and China Shape a New World Order, authored by their director, Charles Grant. And thirdly, I myself and Gudrun Wacker at the Stiftung Wissenschaft und Politik in Berlin have co-edited a report that is at the printers right now. It should be back from the printers this week and hence in the public domain, which means both on the website of the SWP in Berlin, that's www.swp.org, but also in hard copy will be available to in this country and in Europe. So by the end of this week, early next week, I'd encourage you to check the SWP website. It's called American and European Relations with China, Advancing Common Agendas. And all three of these reports really are very complementary and supplementary to each other. And it's interesting, and they've all been undertaken separately, but it's interesting to see the reinforcing dimensions of it. Okay, now the report that Bates and Melissa have co-authored, I think is very important, thoughtful, and timely. It's important for the substantive breadth and depth of the China-Europe relationship that they include in the study across all dimensions. Particularly, they have, I think, contributed on the S&T and cultural exchange and export control dimensions. Those three parts of this report are all new and to the literature, and I think very useful additions. The appendix in itself on European weapon sales is a unique contribution, but I think the discussions of Confucius Institutes and cultural exchanges between China and the EU, as well as the enormous science and technology exchanges between China and the EU, the largest in the world between two parties, is really worth your reading. It's a thoughtful study, both in that it's a very nuanced analysis. They choose their language very carefully, and the specific recommendations that Bates has just given. Very important and a lot of thought lies behind them. They're not simple analyses, and they're also bold analyses. Some of the things he has just mentioned will take a few on Capitol Hill in particular by surprise, but I think it's worth the time of those on Capitol Hill in particular to spend the time thinking through and trying to understand what they have recommended. And it's a timely report because as the United States heads into a new administration in 2009, they will encounter, whoever they are, a changed and complex new world. And one really key dimension of this new world is the China-Europe relationship, which they have detailed the growth of this relationship over the last decade in the report. And I agree completely. Americans, American public, American policy elites, the administration, and particularly the Congress, need to understand the breadth and depth of this relationship going forward. Americans have a series of blind spots. One of them is that when we look at Asia and China, we look only across the Pacific. We don't understand that China and other Asian countries, for that matter, have relations with countries in other parts of the world. But you know, I would say in the last year we've begun to understand better China's relations in Africa. Again, Bates, when he was here as the Freeman Chair, contributed, I think, the first study, really, of China-Africa relations, trying to bring the Washington policy community's attention to that. We need to learn more about China-Latin America relations. There are some ongoing projects there. I myself am going down there in July to try and learn more. But the China-Europe relationship is really one of the key ones. So I think their analysis and their recommendations are really important for the new administration going forward. And I share some of his concerns about whether the dialogue will be, the official dialogue between the State Department and the European Commission will be continued, at what protocol level, and so on. I think there's a whole lot of work to be done there to not only continue it, but improve it. Now, let's see. Going forward in time, what might we look for as this relationship evolves? The study is an excellent study of the last 5 to 10 years. I think when we look at the next 2 to 3 years, there are about 6 or 7 variables that I think we will have to keep our eye on that will affect the orientation and the scope of the relationship. The first is the impact of trade and the politics of trade on the European economies and the workforce. The European trade deficit with China is growing at a faster rate, in fact, than the U.S., than the American trade deficit with China. And at the current rate of growth, will overtake the U.S. trade deficit in 2010, if the statistics I've seen are correct. But it's the politics of this that really are beginning to bite and grip across the continent in Europe, and some countries, particularly the Mediterranean and Central European countries, more than the more developed West European countries, as their hollowed-out tertiary industries are being badly affected, and their workforce is badly affected by China. Not just trade from China to Europe, but, in fact, Chinese production facilities in Europe. I was in Italy last week and learned about this city, Prato, which is near Florence, of which has a population of 180,000 people, 50,000 of which are Chinese workers who have been brought in to work round the clock, 24/7, in very poor conditions, very Guangdong-like conditions, to produce various designer handbags and shoes and leather goods, and then they are sold on the European market, and they are able to put the made in Italy label on them and sell them for $1,000 per Gucci handbag. You know why? Because they were actually made in Prato, not in Guangdong. So this is, and it's causing enormous discontent in Italy, actually. And there was a documentary on Italian television last week or 2 weeks ago that exposed the working conditions of these factories. So it's become a kind of human rights issue, or worker rights issue, as well as a trade issue. But anyway, the first issue is trade. Peter Mandelson has been warning now for over a year, as Melissa indicated, on numerous occasions at very high and vocal levels, that if China doesn't really grasp the severity of this issue, protectionist barriers are going to go up. And a trade, not necessarily a trade war, but some real tit-for-tat actions could be taken. So that issue I would put first. The second variable is the degree of Chinese responsiveness to the series of concerns that the European Commission noted in that October 2006 communication document that Melissa referred to. That document is worth your reading if you haven't read it. In it, there are over 24 concerns or markers that the EU put down. They aren't demands. The EU doesn't do that. But the question is the extent to which the Chinese side is responding to that document and subsequent reiterations of those concerns by Barroso as recently as 2 weeks ago in his visit to Beijing, and now in their new high-level economic mechanism. The Europeans have started a counterpart to the Strategic Economic Dialogue and have put down a number of markers in the financial services, IPR, trade realms that the Chinese are, you know, the term arbuton. They're listening, but they're not listening. There is not a an appropriate Chinese response on these issues. And the European side is getting increasingly frustrated. So the question then is, what are they going to do about it, and when will this frustration really crystallize? It's getting close on a number of issues. Third variable I see going forward is the relationship between the Commission, European Commission, and the member states. This is an ongoing intra-European issue, but there is a sense that the Commission was out in front of the member states on China policy up until October 2006. This communication document that Melissa refers to represents a greater harmonization of Brussels with the member states, and they're now more in sync within the EU, and they're more in sync across the Atlantic with the Bush administration as a result. But it doesn't mean that that harmonization will necessarily continue. So you have to watch intra-European politics on this. And I agree with Melissa that the changing administrations in Berlin, Paris, and London have positively affected the harmonization of intra-European policies towards China. That's been a good thing. A fourth factor are the pace and scope of internal reforms in China that the EU has invested in. Again, this is one of the strengths of this report, and Melissa spoke to that, but the Europeans have invested heavily in various reforms domestically in China. That is their major concern. Europeans would like to assist China to make many transitions in their reform processes domestically, whereas Americans tend to look at what China's doing outside its borders, potentially, to disrupt, potentially, the international regional order. Europeans have a very different orientation. But there's kind of a sense of donor fatigue setting in Europe about some of these significant contributions the EU has made. The fifth is the issue of global governance. The European Union has one of the markers they put down in the last 2 years is that China is to echo Robert Zoellick's call for China to play an increased responsible stakeholder role and to step up to the plate and assume a greater sense of responsibility for a series of global issues and stop being a free rider on the international institutional community. The Europeans are very concerned about this. Climate change is at the top of their list, but peacekeeping operations, international institutional architectural reform, energy security, a whole series of issues. So the question is whether China is going to do that and do it to the satisfaction level. And ODA is another issue, by the way, particularly in Africa. European governments are very concerned about Chinese ODA and aid, no strings attached aid programs in Africa to an extent greater than the United States, I would argue. So there's a whole series of global issues there that I think are going to affect it. And then finally, there are unexpected issues like Tibet that can arise that will affect the relationship. Let me just close, if I can. There are other issues that will affect how the relationship evolves, but those are some to kind of keep our eye on. Let me just take a couple minutes, if I can, Charles, to offer a few additional recommendations, some of which, in fact, just build on what Bates and Melissa have said. First is, I think the United States and Europe need to kind of step back on occasion and remember that we're engaged in a common project with China and towards China. That is, for 30 years now, since the third plenum and the reform and opening policy, both Europe and the U.S. have been involved in trying to assist internal Chinese reforms. We both want China to succeed in a series of economic, social, and political reforms domestically. And we sort of have to remember that dimension of the big picture. The other dimension of the big picture is integrating China into the global system without disrupting that system, bringing China into that system institutionally and normatively getting China to work together with the United States and Europe on these issues of global governance. So we just have to not get lost in the trees and occasionally remind ourselves of the forest, these two dimensions of the forest, I would argue. We need to increase transatlantic dialogues, as their report recommends. But within that, I'd say we need to better wed together the communities of transatlanticists, that is to say, Europeanists in this country, and Americanists in Europe, together with the Sinological community. Right now we have sort of two parallel dialogues going on between European Sinologists and American Sinologists, and between European Americanists and American Europeanists, and we need to triangulate those a little bit better, I think, and go beyond dialogue and actually create some working groups across the Atlantic in various areas concerning China. Third, we need to trilateralize some of these dialogues, as Bates argued, to bring China in, particularly on the global governance issues. We need to not only have dialogue with the Chinese side about a whole range of global governance issues, but again can, I think, usefully institutionalize some of that dialogue through some working groups between Europe, U.S., and China. Fourth, we have to remember that the U.S. and the EU have different equities and interests and responsibilities in Asia and respect to China that really affect each of our relations with China. I mean, for the Europeans, there is no Taiwan issue. There is no Taiwan lobby. That's a big, there's no sense of responsibility for Taiwan's security. There's no real interest in Taiwan in Europe. It's completely different than the United States, and it's obviously one major factor that does not affect China-Europe relations. The other is the U.S. Security responsibilities in East Asia more broadly and our five alliances and military deployments in East Asia. There isn't a single European soldier deployed in East Asia. There isn't a single European alliance in East Asia. There isn't that whole security dimension that weighs so heavily on the U.S.-China relationship, along with the Taiwan issue, absent, simply not there. Now, that's a good thing or a bad thing, you can argue, but it has facilitated the growth of China-Europe relations in a way that the U.S. has had to deal with differently. Fifth, as a matter of urgency, I think one really important part about their report is the attention they draw to technology transfer issues and link it to the arms embargo, so-called arms embargo. Bates is absolutely correct about it. But I think there is a time bomb waiting to explode in transatlantic relations with regard to dual-use technology transfers to China. Same kind of time bomb that we sensed in 2003, 2004 with regard to the arms embargo. Unless there is some harmonization across the Atlantic of dual-use technology transfer categories, that there will be European sales and transfers of technologies that are not in violation of European law or controls, but are very much in contravention of U.S. Commerce Department export controls. And the Congress will go ballistic as soon as some, you know, item is sold by some European company to some Chinese entity. So I've, you know, really think we've got to pay really immediate attention to this issue, and we're not going to get in complete harmony. I've argued that we need a kind of red light, yellow light, green light system that we used to have, Charles, if you remember, in the Reagan administration on export controls to China. Red light, absolutely under no conditions would the United States approve of such a technology being sold. Yellow light means case-by-case evaluation. Green light, technologies that the United States could live with if they were sold. But right now, there are no lights across the Atlantic. There is no communication on the tech transfer issue. There is no, the Wassenaar agreement is hollow. I'm not calling for a new COCOM. I'm simply calling for some dialogue between the U.S. Commerce Department and other parts of our export control bureaucracy and the European side. Increased public education, fifth. Bates has already made that point, so I'll just underscore it. But we need to get the American public and particularly the American Congress and even the American expert community aware of this relationship, and your report is an important first step there. A couple of last ones, and I'll stop. We need to, I think, rethink and recalibrate what's called capacity-building efforts in China. Both the U.S., but particularly the EU, has been deeply involved in capacity building in China. But there is this sense of donor fatigue that is setting in Europe and even in the U.S., and I would argue that we need to recalibrate ODA and private sector work in China away from poverty alleviation work towards what we call public sphere and NGO community building work. Leave the poverty alleviation to the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and the Chinese government itself. I don't think that is a Western responsibility anymore, to be candid about it. I think that Western money can be spent on other things that help China transition into being a newly industrializing country and polity. So I think there needs to be some reorientation of some of this ODA money. And then lastly, we need to listen carefully to each side's use of language. This meeting we were just at in Stockholm, I listened very interestingly to the Chinese, the Americans, and the Europeans' use of the word multilateralism. But we're not speaking the same language when we talk about multilateralism. For the EU, it's institutionally based multilateralism based on international law and global institutions. For the U.S., it's really coalitions, ad hoc coalitions of the willing. The six-party talks is an example. How often do you hear the term six-party talks and multilateralism in the same sentence? It's not a multilateral institution. It's a multinational institution of six parties who happen to be working on that. Same with Iran. So, and then if you listen to the Chinese on multilateralism, what they're really talking about is UN-based and sovereign-based international intergovernmental organizations, not pooling sovereignty, but reinforcing sovereignty, supplemented by regional organizations like the SCO. So, you know, while we can all use the same language, it doesn't mean we're all using it in the same way. And I think we need to kind of listen more carefully about that. So I just commend the report to you and commend Bates and Melissa on their authorship. I think it's a major contribution to Washington policy considerations, and I can only hope that the Washington policy community gives it appropriate attention.
Thanks all of you. Before we throw it open to questions, just tell a little anecdote, again, from the last couple of days, which I think really, to my mind, really demonstrated some of the challenges in China-Europe relations. If, without trying to break Chatham House rules, we had one participant from Brussels who wanted to underscore how important the issue of climate change is to Europeans generally, and how the European public increasingly looks at China's approach to climate change and actually thinks this is something the Chinese are doing that's killing us. So the depth of anxiety within Europe about China's approach to climate change or emissions of greenhouse gases is something that European publics look as tantamount to an act of war. He said, and sort of after he said this, and so it's absolutely incumbent on us to reach a collaborative accord and approach to climate change that allows us to calm down our respective publics. And a Chinese participant stopped there at that point and said, "Well, you know, I just want to tell you that we do have a very strong approach to environmentalism now. We've changed it. And I look up at this beautiful hall, and these are all incandescent lights. In China, we mandate the use of fluorescent lighting, which is vastly more efficient and therefore less producing of greenhouse gases. And so I'm sitting here, and the Chinese participant said, I'm looking at this, and I'm seeing hypocrisy." And another European participant said, "Yes, we'd love to use more fluorescent lighting, but we have strong anti-dumping duties against Chinese fluorescent lights that prohibit us from using those. So they're just not available." So anyway, I thought that was an interesting little view into some of the challenges and opportunities that exist between the EU and China. And it's not going to be easy for them to reach an accord as similar as it is for us to generate the kind of common approach to China that is not does not look like ganging up. So this is I want to congratulate both Melissa and Bates for I think a really stimulating report, and I commend it to you all and would like to open it for questions.
A question about your report alluded to the rather limited scope of the U.S.-EU dialogue on China that began in 2005, and I wondered if you could give us a better sense of, and also that maybe it had been, continued at rather low levels in recent periods. And I wondered if you give us a sense, is there an openness among European governments to talk about, I know I heard you, Bates, say that it shouldn't be necessarily a policy it should be policy harmonization, but not necessarily coordination or organization against China, but or be seen in that way. But is there a sense that there are areas where there ought to be sort of some bilateral and some trilateral, if you will, matters handled, and is there a certain openness? Because even when David recounted the title of the Center for European Reform report, it implied sort of that some of the Europeans, at least, are thinking of China and the U.S. balancing U.S. Dominance in the international system and maybe showing a sign, at least among the analytic community, of some resistance to that. Secondly, you mentioned in the report that the growing some military exercises and some cooperation and peacekeeping between China and EU countries. Have any of the European countries had any more serious kind of dialogue with the Chinese on strategic stability or any other kinds of issues along the lines that the U.S. has had with China, either in a track one or track two context?
I'll say a few words, and I'm sure David and Melissa might want to chime in as well. On the specifics of the ongoing transatlantic dialogue on Asia and China, it was intended to be held every 6 months. It exchanges, one in Brussels, the next one in Washington. When in Europe, I think it's also been an occasion for our participants to also drop in on other capitals, and carry out similar consultations in, say, London or Berlin, Paris, on a bilateral basis. As originally conceived, I think it involved one participant from the National Security Council, one participant from the State Department, and one participant from the Commerce Department. And when it was first conceived, it was at the Assistant Secretary level. So in the first set of meetings, it involved our own Michael Green from CSIS, Chris Hill, and I don't remember who the gentleman or woman was from the Commerce Department. That has, I think, steadily eroded in protocol level, and there are a lot of reasons for it. I mean, I think on the one hand, maybe there's a sense that the crisis has been resolved. The crisis which prompted it all, the arms embargo, seems to be shelved for the moment. I think there's a sense of satisfaction in Washington that this has been taken care of. I'm not so sure about that. Also, of course, Assistant Secretary Hill is extremely busy in the work he is trying to accomplish vis-a-vis the Korean Peninsula. But I think, too, it's just a sort of meeting fatigue. I mean, it's not easy for people who work on Asian issues to get on an airplane and fly to Brussels. I mean, it seems counterintuitive, I think, to busy officials to do that kind of thing. So I think it is in decline. The broader question of whether or not there's a sense in Brussels about the importance of this, maybe I should ask David to respond to that, because he does spend a lot of time speaking directly with officials there on these questions. Maybe you have a word or two to say. On the strategic dialogue, I mean, the United Kingdom and France, the two nuclear powers of Europe, do have senior-level and ongoing discussions on security-related issues, on non-proliferation-related issues with the Chinese. I mean, maybe if there are some representatives from those governments here, they could add some more detail on what those discussions entail. But I suspect our own strategic dialogue with China on nuclear issues hasn't gone very far, quite frankly, officially speaking. So I don't suspect there's been much movement or progress or interesting developments either between those bilateral ones between France and the UK and China. Something may come up in the course of the next year and a half as we see a buildup on the whole disarmament question that might arise in 2009. Maybe that will spark some greater conversation, but I'm skeptical.
Well, in addition to what Bates just said, I think that there has been one round of European Council strategic dialogue with China last autumn. I don't know the content of the agenda, but I did talk to somebody who participated in it, and it was basically a kind of mutual briefing where the Europeans brief the Chinese side on the European defense strategy and the common European security policy, whereas the Chinese basically gave the briefing of the most recent defense white paper. So kind of mutual briefings of things that are already well known. But, you know, it's a start. There is no yet, there hasn't been a NATO-China dialogue, at least institutionalized. There have been some ad hoc meetings between NATO and the PLA. But that's another one that I would point to that needs to be started. But the main thing is, I agree with Bates, that the American attention to this transatlantic dialogue on China that was started in 2005 is the problem. It's not the European side, it's the American side. And there are various reasons for it. But I think where there's a will, there's a way. And I don't think there's an American will here. That's the problem. Particularly in the State Department. The last round that was held, we were on our side represented by the director of the China desk, not even a deputy assistant secretary level, much less the assistant secretary level. Nor are we bringing the European side of the State Department and the Asian side, EAP, to the table in these meetings. The NSC hasn't even been represented in the last two rounds of this dialogue. The Europeans express great frustration with this. You know, you Americans are just not giving this adequate attention, and they're right. But I would submit it's not just a two-day-a-year question and whether the Americans are giving it adequate protocol attention. I think we need a 365-day-a-year dialogue, and that's why I call for the establishment of U.S.-EU working groups on series of six or seven of issues related to China that we both have major concern on: energy security, human rights, trade. You know, you can fill in the blanks, but we need to get our two bureaucracies married together, and then those two bureaucracies need to be married to the expert community. In other words, we can have European and American experts on these issue areas working together, feeding into the USG and the EU bureaucracy so that they then can produce some real cooperation, not just dialogue for half a day, twice a year. So I think that, you know, yes, there was a good start in 2005, but I share Bates' concern that this is not going where it ought to, and it's the Americans' problem, not the European side.
Farid Shvuho from the Heinrich Böll Foundation. No, I'm from Germany, and I was working on labor and social welfare policies, and especially in this field and in Germany, people are complaining about China because they say, well, the reason why China is able to sell goods to Europe and to the U.S. so cheaply is because they are treating their workers so bad, because they have very bad working conditions. So there have been suggestions of linking the standards of the International Labour Organization to the World Trade Organization, because the International Labour Organization does not have power at all, the World Trade Organization does. As far as I've heard it, it's the U.S., not only China, but the U.S. too, who are going against it. And thinking about it, I would say, well, the U.S. are harmed by the fact that China is treating their workers so bad. So why is that?
It's actually quite interesting. The Europeans and Americans probably have the same concerns over labor issues in China, although I think it also gets into the issue of official concerns, official policy, and then commercial concerns. Because more recently in China has a new labor contract law, which has it's a first step in trying to address some of these issues. Increasing wage pressure now in China, collective bargaining. There have, you know, been some forward movement, but as a result, there are a number of American and EU companies then pulling out of China because these labor contracts are actually impacting their bottom line and moving to Vietnam and other places. So I think you've got a kind of contradiction between what can be done at official policy and then, you know, commercial interests then lobbying against official policy. But I think the EU and the US have pretty much similar views about wanting to improve labor conditions in China. So,
as you probably know, the issue of labor standards and trade agreements, let alone the WTO, is highly controversial everywhere, not just here, but in Europe as well. The notion of negotiating an entire new WTO GATT agreement that includes labor standards is something that I think there will be a lot of discussion about in the next administration, whomever it is. Whether or not that goes anywhere is another question.
Thanks. There's been a lot of talk, especially among U.S. financial services groups, about joining forces with European financial services groups in terms of discussions on market access, other issues of common concern, which was touched on today. Some of those folks are also talking about attempting to formally join the EU high-level mechanism and the U.S. strategic economic dialogue. Is that anything that's anywhere near feasible, either in terms of the politics of the U.S. and the EU, as well as China's reaction? Is that anything that you even considered while you were working on your report? And secondly, on the export control issue that you folks talked about, is there any policy mechanism and or political will to try and create this harmonization that you folks are talking about? I mean, when Chris Padilla was in charge of BIS and went over from the Department of Commerce to try and sell the Europeans on the new U.S. export control system and the verified end user program, he came back and told the press that he was greeted with active listening, which when you're talking about one of the bigger salesmen of this policy, when he is describing the reaction as that, you can tell that there's not a lot of goodwill towards U.S. export control policy, especially towards China. So is there any chance of actually moving through a policy process on this export control issue?
I'll just address your first question on the high-level economic and trade dialogue. That was actually just agreed to in November of 2007, which was when we were trying to wrap up our report, so we didn't really address, you know, the long-term future of that mechanism. But I'd say, given the difficulties that have already been experienced in achieving tangible results on the U.S.-China SED, I don't really foresee a coming together of the Europeans and the U.S. or the Chinese actually agreeing to that sort of joint approach at that level, not the foreseeable future.
I think there's even serious questions about whether the SED will survive into the next administration. Maybe a place to look more likely would probably be within the WTO, perhaps, where there might be some further joint U.S.-Europe cooperation and the like. But I think Charles could probably speak more knowledgeably on that question. On the export control issue, I think it's in a sort of a catch-22 problem. I mean, first of all, the Europeans themselves are at odds with one another about the code of conduct, which would be a more strengthened, a more binding set of understandings and regulations applying to sensitive technology and weapon exports from the EU, and just how firm and how fast these regulations can actually apply across the EU 27. So there's already, let alone the transatlantic dimensions of this, there's real infighting within Europe about how strict these things should be and what they should say. I mean, that's probably a thing that we all have to keep in mind as we think all through. You know, we refer to the EU as some sort of, you know, monolithic entity, and it certainly is not, far from it. So we always have to keep the individual interests of the member states in mind whenever we talk about anything the EU itself can accomplish. So there's that problem. So active listening is not necessarily hostility, but it's also a reflection of paralysis. if you can't do anything internally, all you can really do is nod your head and listen. But a second catch-22 on this is that to move towards some sort of harmonization as we've envisioned would presumably require the lifting of the arms embargo. And that has all the ramifications of the debacle of 2005, because people over here don't get it. So the first big hump to get over is to convince Capitol Hill particularly that you can get to a better place than we are now through the lifting of the arms embargo. But you can do that through a process that seeks harmonization first, seeks to have a legally binding system in place in Europe first, which can be satisfactorily appreciated in the United States and in European capitals as being fair and being appropriately structured to stem the flow of sensitive weapons and technologies, not only to China, but around the world. And if that can be accomplished, then a lifting can occur. But as long as it has this political element to it and the depth of misunderstanding about it, that can't happen. So Padilla goes over there with these ideas, but he runs into these, both the internal problem and then the transatlantic dimension of it.
Let me just add a couple points to what Bates said. He runs into problems for two reasons. One is that the Europeans feel that the U.S. Commerce Department regulations on tech transfer to China are excessive and draconian, so they don't agree with the new levels. They think they're extreme. One can judge that as you like. It may reflect the fact that Europeans don't have as great a concern about Chinese military modernization as Americans do. But they don't agree is the first point, so they listen politely. Secondly, they really, the point that's always emphasized to me by Europeans is we don't want to be dictated to by you Americans on this issue. We have our sovereignty, transatlantic sovereignty, and we don't want to have a set of American controls imposed on us. And I think that's why there is a way, and we have to appreciate that on the American side, but there is a way to harmonize controls while still respecting European sensitivities and sovereignty. That's why I suggest this three-light system, for example. It doesn't mean that on every case that comes before the Commerce Department or a European equivalent will be cross-cleared across the Atlantic. That's not what I'm indicating. I'm just saying we need some categories that will guide the decisions in which both sides agree, in these three categories. And it needs to be linked to the code of conduct. Bates is absolutely right. If the code of conduct, revised code of conduct, can demonstrably be shown to be much stronger on controlling technology transfer and both of a military nature and end-use weapon systems to China, then hopefully the Congress can be persuaded. But it has to marry together the tech transfer dimension to the code of conduct. And that hasn't really been done within the EU yet. The EU has their own export controls that at the member state levels, as Bates says, but they also have it at the EU level, and they're legally binding. They're available on their website. But they're not married together well enough with the code of conduct. So this is all very complicated bureaucratic kind of stuff, but those on both sides of the Atlantic, I think, need to have a discussion about this. Otherwise, it's going to explode in our face politically.
And yeah, just a final word on that. I mean, one has to remember also that there's a fundamental Chinese problem with restrictions on technology transfer that runs very, very deep. Remember, when opening up back in 78 had two primary goals. One was to attract investment for employment purposes, and the second was technology transfer. There is extreme levels of dissatisfaction in China with the pace and extent of technology transfer. So further restrictions on technology transfer are greeted with not just skepticism, but it's essentially, you've broken the deal. The deal was investment and tech transfer, and we've only gotten half that. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Carol Kalinowski, a consultant and an attorney working for many years in export controls. And I would like to make a comment with what you've said, because just a few weeks ago there was a very interesting report done by CSIS on whether or not export controls in the 21st century ought to be really rethought. Mr. Shambaugh, you talk about dual-use technologies, and that may be a ticking time bomb, but truly, in the age of globalization, maybe the entire structure of export controls as we know it has to be rethought because, again, the Commerce Department, with the China rule last year, has sought to recontrol 31 items that the Europeans don't think are important. The new China rule essentially requires a license for everything going to China. Has it stemmed the exports of these things? No, because now you have companies relocating offshore so that they can get these items to China because it is not believed to be significant from the standpoint of enhancing the lethality of certain military programs. So I wonder whether or not this has to be conjoined with looking at whether or not export controls should be rethought in light of what's going on in the world today. And again, my question is, you talk about harmonization and coordination between the United States and Europe with respect to China issues. But how are we going to get the executive branch and the Congress to sit down to coordinate and to think about what should China policy be? Because the United States has no China policy with respect to export controls and nonproliferation.
Well, what you mean is there is a policy. It's just that you don't think it's very wise,
I don't think it's united policy, because again, you have the folks at the State Department having a prohibition to China with the ITAR, export control duties is another thing. Nuclear regulatory is very different when it comes to civilian nuclear materials.
Okay. Right.
And you can get a coordinated articulation of what is current China policy in this administration.
I think you and I are very much in agreement. I don't want to sound as if I disagree with you. I don't. And you and I have had many conversations on this topic. I'm no expert of the United States bureaucracy and Congress and its relationships and how to move those sorts of questions forward. But I totally agree with you that under the current political circumstances and our relationship toward China, the sort of underlying strategic mistrust and depth of concern which persists and is, I don't see going improving much in any near term, it'll be politically toxic, I would think, for any administration or any congressman to step up and make the argument that this all needs to be revisited. So I don't see much in the way of prospects. So I take your point that if that can't happen, then how can we possibly expect it to happen across the Atlantic? It's a good, which then underscores further David's concern that we're looking at another potential train wreck on tech transfer questions with the Europeans going forward.
Thank you. Dieter Detke, Georgetown University. Can you enlighten us, please, about the Shanghai Cooperation Council and how far it can go? Obviously, there are tensions between China and Russia, but there's also a tendency to somehow limit the influence of the West in Central Asia in particular. And does it limit in any way possibilities of a cooperation, direct cooperation between Europe and China and the United States and China?
Okay, well, I'll say a few words on it. I think I have a slightly different view about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization than many. Many in our government, I think, tend to be dismissive of it and don't believe it's all that important. Now, at one extreme, I agree with them. That is to say, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is not an alliance. It's not going to be some sort of a strategic counterweight to American activity in the region. So there I quite agree, and I don't lose sleep over that either. On the other hand, though, I think it's an interesting demonstration or model, at least from the Chinese perspective, about how it can effectively and productively engage neighbors with which not that long ago it had quite hostile and difficult relations. It was through the Shanghai cooperation process, for example, that the borders have been demarcated and agreed upon between China and its four Central Asian neighbors that are within the SCO. It is through the SCO that these partners have been able to sort of put forward the notion that extremism, separatism, and terrorism are issues of mutual concern, and under that umbrella, I think they're able to put into place policy on the ground to suppress activity and to cooperate in suppressing activity that they deem to be troubling within their own domestic polities. And it's a mechanism under which there is ongoing and regularized communication and contact across the bureaucracies of these different countries. So maybe it has a longer-term impact in at least helping China to establish basically stable and friendly, basically stable relations with countries where maybe it wasn't going to be so friendly if we looked at it 10 or 15 years ago. That has a long-term strategic effect, I think. that improves China's standing in the region. As to whether or not there ought to be increased cooperation, that's something, yes, I think there are, I've advocated for a long time. There probably ought to be some effort to establish a kind of NATO or SCO discussion. There ought to be some effort to see whether or not we can't spend more time in Uzbekistan at the SCO's regional anti-terrorism structure based in Tashkent. But so far, that's been rebuffed, I think. I would also say that some of the things that have come out of the SCO, like calling for foreign forces to leave Central Asia, some of the statements coming out maybe 5 or 6 years ago concerning American hegemony and American unilateralism have not helped and have not made it really politically possible for the United States to be actively engaged with the SCO, and has sort of created a dynamic which has made it more strained than cooperative. But I see more to the SCO than most people, and hopefully a mechanism could be created over time to try to work within it or learn more about it and make it a more cooperative exercise. Charles disagrees, I think.
Only slightly. The question is for the United States, I can't speak for Europe, is whether or not that the challenge of an organization which is specifically created with a view towards countering U.S. influence in a region, or at least presenting itself as a non-U.S. Interested group, should threaten the United States, and whether if you consider it a threat, whether there is some a need to establish counterweight organizations and the like. And I think the answer to that is A, I don't believe it's a genuine threat. I don't believe it's likely to develop into any serious alliance of any substance. And B, I don't believe that the existence of a challenging organization necessarily requires that the United States set up a competing organization. I think that's the something that I think the next administration will be looking at is what do we do? What sort of counterweight do we need to provide? I think in that regard, I'm much more likely to advocate ignorance of the SCO as a factor in Central Asia than I would to argue for greater attention to the SCO. If not, I want to ask you to join me in thanking our panel, and I again want to congratulate the completion of this report, and I commend it to you, and I hope that this is the beginning of a longer dialogue on China-EU relations and the U.S. Role therein. Thank you very much.